Continuing care retirement communities are marketed as having one major selling point. As the name implies, they offer a broad range of care. So residents' needs, whatever those needs might turn out to be at a particular point in time, can be handled on the same campus. Stay tuned, because after I talk to my next guest, I will be giving you more information about how these centers are currently reconfiguring themselves so they will become even more appealing to seniors. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Everybody makes New Year's promises about losing weight. That's probably the most common New Year's promise out there, but most people do not keep them. What can you do to improve the chances you will keep your promise to watch your diet? What are some hints for dieters?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, such a hot topic this time of year in particular. One thing I always try to stress to people is focusing on the big picture, not focusing on the scale, not solely looking, hoping to get to a certain number on that scale, but focusing on the little positive changes along the way that are improved when you start to take care of your body through food, through exercise. I was just reading an email from a client, actually, who went to a concert last night in Louisville and was so excited she was able to wear heels, and boots with heels on them, and dance at the concert. And she said for the first time since she can remember, she actually feels great the next day after dancing for 3 hours at a concert. Those are the kind of things that I think are really meaningful for people when they're looking at long-term change. Again, not just focusing on a certain number on a scale.
And you think looking for these small goals will help you to watch your diet, help you to be more careful?
Well, exactly. When you find something that's important to you, that's meaningful, it's those small goals that will help you stay in tune with your diet. Again, because obviously this person, the example I just gave, that person, the changes she has made through her diet, through her exercise, allowed her to be able to dance in heels and not be laid out the next day. And that's the kind of stuff that keeps people going and motivated versus trying to get to X number on the scale.
There is some thought that people can harm themselves by losing and then regaining weight.
Right.
And that pattern can be even more harmful than simply keeping on the weight. Is that assumption true? Is it important? Is it something people have to consider?
Well, it is certainly something. I've seen some interesting studies come out showing that losing weight and gaining weight and going back and forth, that cycling, that yo-yo that so many people do, may actually hurt your ability to lose weight later on and keep it off. So, again, the goal is to do it, to stick with it, and to find out what motivates you to make those positive changes.
Can you give an example of somebody who has found a motivation? You talked before about small goals, being able to wear heels and dance, or maybe being able to walk up certain steps or play with your grandchildren, whatever it is. Can you give an example of somebody who has held those goals and really kept their body in tune for years?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, I got another client I've worked with is a grandmother. And again, this is something her motivator was to be able to get up off the ground and play with her grandkids. Because at the time, she said she would make lots of excuses. Grandma's busy, can't play, et cetera, et cetera. And it really kind of broke her heart that she wasn't able to do that. And then over time, again, simple movement, simple changes in her nutrition and lifestyle, she realized that she wasn't making those excuses anymore, and she was actually playing with them. And then it was one time, she said she remembers they were playing outside in the summertime, and her grandson actually had tripped, and she went to help pick him up. She tripped as well, and then they both but got up with ease. And again, that was something that, to this woman, that was like the biggest achievement of her life. To her, she just won the Olympics. And again, it was those small changes that helped her achieve those goals. Another woman recently said she was skipping as part of a workout we were doing, and again, she can't remember the last time she ever skipped. So it's things like that a lot of people take for granted, but ultimately when they're big for, everyone's goals are unique and everyone is has their own important situation that they benefit from.
Mm-hmm. What you say is very wonderful, almost inspiring, but you talk about skipping. Well, wonderful. But doesn't that have to mean every day? Doesn't that mean this is something you really have to stick with and it's not easy?
Right. It's not that it's not easy. It's people need to find the time, or I shouldn't say find, they should need to make the time. So I mentioned skipping. Yes, people should be moving every single day. Doesn't mean you have to go to the gym every day. Doesn't mean you have to spend, you know, an hour walking on a treadmill. But you need to do something. We're not meant to sit. Okay. When you look at the research, people who are active and people who aren't still sit about the same amount of time every single day, because most people have sedentary jobs. You go to the gym for 30 minutes, let's say, then you drive to the office, you sit in front of a computer, you go home, you sit down for dinner, you sit down and watch TV, and you lay down. That's the life of most people. That's not supposed to be how it is. We're not meant to sit. So we do need to move as much and as often as possible. It might just mean every hour getting up and walking around for a few minutes. And the simple act, if you a test that I do with a lot of people, it's simple to really highlight how important it is to move and then get your heart rate going. When you're sitting, if you take your heart rate, you take your pulse, and all you do is stand up, you take your pulse again, your pulse will go up. That means that simple act of standing up makes your heart work just a tiny bit harder, okay? It takes more than that, of course, but think about the difference when you're standing of how your heart is starting to work, your body, your brain, and everything, because of the increase in blood flow and the muscles are engaged.
Now, you almost feel obliged to ask the obvious question. More and more people are talking about diet, tending to diet. More and more people are coming on TV or elsewhere through the media talking about diet. It becomes a national prerogative to get people being more active and lose weight. And yet, despite all of this, we all know what's happening. People are getting heavier and getting heavier at a younger age.
Right.
How do you explain that? Is this a trend that maybe has to do with the stress people are under? Is this a trend that's due to the amount of advertising on TV for certain foods? To what do you attribute that?
Yeah, well, I think all of the above. I think it's a big piece to the puzzle, or these are all pieces to the puzzle. It's food, it's activity or inactivity. Like you said, people are becoming heavier and heavier, younger and younger in their lives. We're seeing diseases that we never, ever thought of in kids now pop up in children, like type 2 diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure and so on. So I think it's all of those things. We can't pinpoint just one. It's one or the other. But when you start to put all those pieces of the puzzle together is when you truly start to make change and make change permanent.
But do you believe that type of lifestyle change to be possible on a national level?
I do. I do. I think that, you know, especially around this time of the year, we're going to see a lot more about diet and everything else. But it is that type of lifestyle change is possible. And again, that's what we need to make things permanent. It's not about a quick fix. It's not about a pill or a potion or a fast weight loss diet, 20 pounds in a month or whatever it is. It's about that lifestyle. People need to take that initiative and take responsibility to make the change for themselves, okay, whether it's not going to fast food as often or whether it's cutting out the diets or the regular sodas or whatever it may be. Those are all lifestyle changes, and I think it can be on a national level, and it needs to be.
Okay, you mentioned diet soda. I feel obliged to ask you about something. As I'm sure you know, Mayor Bloomberg, or outgoing Mayor Bloomberg at this point in New York, wanted regulations whereby you could only get so much diet soda, could only be so large. Do you think things like that are helpful as constant reminders, or do you think they're just, to use the wrong expression, sugarcoating, just something that, well, we're doing something?
Right.
Just
politics. I think I think there's a little piece of that. I mean, at the end of the day, people need to take responsibility. I don't think necessarily that simply that act of, you know, cutting out the size of the sodas or decreasing will make a huge dent. I mean, it certainly can't. I don't think it can hurt. But if people want to buy another soda, they could just buy another. So I don't necessarily think it would make a huge impact on the life of the the health and life of the person. So I think it's a fine line between again personal responsibility and then the government taking over and trying to make those changes and force those changes. But it's tough. Again, things like that, at the end of the day, will I think they make a huge impact? Not necessarily. I think you could say the same for a lot of food companies are now putting calories and fat on their menus. Does that have a huge impact? And there's been studies to show yes and studies to show no. You know, I think the people who has the most impact for are people who are already aware of what that even means. So when I walk into a restaurant and I see my calories listed on there, to me, I said, oh, that might click something, that I might make a different decision or what have you. But some people may have no idea what it even means. Is 500 calories too much? Is 1,000 calories too much? People don't know.
How would you respond if somebody came to you and said, well, Chris, maybe what you're doing is wonderful and maybe it helps some people, but I've always been heavy. Others in my family are heavy. Some of my friends are heavy. How am I going to turn that around?
Well, yeah, I do hear that all the time. It's genetics, and I have no hope. And the people who you spend the most time with, you'll be like them. And there was a study that came out a few years ago now, showing that if your friends are overweight, you will actually be overweight as well. Or I should say, you're more likely to be overweight. Not necessarily you will, because again, who you spend the most time with, you will be like. So it does take that responsibility and that effort to make the change yourself. So I think that's important when we're trying to talk about this message of changing your own lifestyle. You need to figure out why you want to, number one, why it's important to you, and then ultimately make that change.
Now, what if somebody comes to you and they say, I'm heavy, I know I'm heavy, I don't need the scale to tell me, but, whoa, wait a minute, I just went to the doctor and my blood pressure is in one appropriate limits. My cholesterol level is in with appropriate limits. My glucose level is within appropriate limits. I get around. I lead my life. So what? So I'm heavy. So I am.
Right.
That's me.
Yep.
I mean, they go a step further than just saying, hey, I'm heavy. Always have been. What can be done? They say I'm heavy and to blank.
Right.
I'm healthy. How
right.
would you respond?
Yeah, I get the same question. I have an aunt who's the same exact way. She, my one aunt and uncle are both morbidly obese. He's a physician. She's a nurse. They certainly are aware of the health consequences. But my aunt has everything, like you mentioned, her cholesterol, her blood sugar, everything is great, right within those limits that it should be. So a lot of it for her is, well, it hasn't hurt me yet. Now, in the same sentence, she often complains that her ankles hurt or her knees hurt. She can't walk very far and things like that. And she can't get up and down off the ground. She was recently visiting and actually trying to putting our daughter. We have two daughters, a 2- and a 4-year-old, and our 4-year-old wanted her to put her to bed. Well, simple things that my wife and I take for granted. We lay down with my daughter at night and read her a story. Well, my aunt couldn't get in and out of that bed easily enough. And obviously she does it at home, but with our daughter, she has those little things on the side of her bed to keep her from falling out. So my aunt actually couldn't get over those to get into the bed with her. Now, that had a little bit of an impact on her because she commented on it, and her son, my cousin, just got married, and ultimately they'll have some grandkids. And will that have enough of an impact on her to make change herself? No. So even though all those lipids and everything else might be great, those simple day-to-day activities that I take for granted, getting in and out of a bed, are monumental to someone who may not be who may be overweight or obese. Again, not all the time, but sometimes. So again, we need to look at, it's not just about weight by any means, but how is it impacting your life, or is it impacting your life in other ways that may be affecting you?
I'm sure you've heard, I'm bringing up things that I'm sure you've heard many, many times. What if somebody comes to you and they say, I'm 70,
Yep.
I can't lose weight at 70. We're talking about aging.
Right.
In fact, is it harder to lose weight as you age?
It does make it more challenging, but is it necessarily your physiology, or a lot of it is psychological? Because now, I mean, the longer you go and the longer you have these same habits, the more challenging it becomes to break them. So sure, some hormones play a role, and some other, there are some other changes. Usually people are less active as they get older. So it's not necessarily an age thing, but sometimes a lifestyle thing.
And you believe you could change lifestyle at any age?
I do. Again, the older you are, the more challenging it is because you've been now in these habits for however many years. But I think you can. I've seen great research has been done showing people in their early 90s starting a weight training program. They actually get fantastic results and very rapid results. So I absolutely think it's possible. It's that people need to believe it's possible themselves.
A certain mindset you're talking about.
Right.
Now, we mentioned before, and I think it's a very important point to bring up, you see these diet gurus on the TV, over the radio, the internet, all over, books. You walk into most bookstores, there's a whole stack of diet books. Now, some of them come up with claims of the effect sugar is killing you.
Mm-hmm.
You get those who say it's not just how many calories you eat, it's what the calories are, and boy, if you have carbos, those are going to soup up your system in ways that you just can't lose weight, so you got to eat ice cream instead of carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think some of these diets oversimplify to be marketable, in plain English, make it sound like, okay, you do this, boom, your weight will be under control? And everybody is too different for any of these generalities to work.
Right. Well, again, we see lots of these different diets and fads and things coming and going. And, you know, everyone is looking for that quick fix, that overnight quick change, whatever. Maybe it's the carbs, like you mentioned. Maybe it's gluten. Maybe it's protein. Who knows what it is? Maybe it's low fat. That was popular. And as you see, if you've been in this long enough, you can see the different trends coming and going. You know, in the early 1990s, low-fat was the way to go. And then there's a big pendulum switch, and then it was low-carbohydrates. And now, gluten is the big thing. So gluten-free, everything's gluten-free, which is kind of like the low-carb mantra, in a way. So we see a lot of these trends come and go, and the basics always do apply. The basic nutrition principles, eating more color like fruits and veggies, you know, including some lean protein with each meal. The simple basic nutrition principles will never die.
Mm-hmm. Well, these things are very complicated, and some little slogans like, you know, sugar is a killer would oversimplify. I would imagine, I'm not a nutritionist or biochemist, but I would imagine that there's chemically a big difference between the sugar you might get if you eat grapes and the fructose that you get in some carbonated drinks.
Right. There is, again, in that perfect example you gave, there is, you know, the sugar in soda, for example, versus the naturally occurring sugar in fruit. There's a big difference because that one in the fruit is packaged with a whole lot of other vitamins and minerals and nutrients. So, It's a very, very big difference between, you know, soda and broccoli, for example, or whatever fruit or vegetable. So it's not the carbs are bad. It's that the type of carbs are, you know, we want to focus on one more than the other. I think that's important, number one. And number two, again, not demonizing any one food group or any food type, because everything has its role. Every food type has its role. And we need to focus on the overall balance versus the drastic elimination of one thing or another.
You're obviously very knowledgeable and involved in nutrition issues. What in your life led you to that involvement?
For me, I was actually overweight as a kid. And I always wore the Levi Huskies pants that My waist never matched my height, so my mom always had to hem my jeans. I was a size 38 waist, which is bigger than I wear now. And that was the eighth grade. I had to lose 20 pounds to play football because I didn't make weights. I didn't make my weight limit, and I couldn't play with the grade above me now because they were in high school. So at that point, it was to me, for it was either losing 20 pounds or not playing. I lost the weight, and through that process, I got interested in nutrition. And when it was time to apply to college, that's all I wanted to focus on was nutrition. I went to school for nutrition. I ultimately became a dietitian and then got a PhD in exercise physiology. So I love this stuff, and I've been doing it for a long time, both first personally and then now professionally.
How is your great interest in nutrition and knowledge about nutrition impacted upon the way you look at aging? Many people are frightened of aging. Does an understanding of nutrition and exercise, human physiology, make you less frightened of aging because you understand that you can still function quite well at any age? Has it impacted you that way?
Well, a little bit, yeah. I mean, you definitely are very, I think a lot of times people think the natural pattern of aging is you slowly get worse and worse and worse and worse. When the fact of the matter is you can get much, much better. And when you start to put in that effort, when you start to take control of your health through exercise, particularly, I mean, nutrition is always important, but as we age, exercise is particularly important. And I know one of the most important pieces of the puzzle. Just actually moving and actually getting your muscles to move and keep them moving is key. So because one day, you know, the more you move them, the more likely they are to continue moving versus ultimately stopping and doing too much sitting and everything else, and then you start to lose muscle mass at a very rapid pace.
But how can you avoid that as you get older when it may be harder for you to move? Do you have to go to someone who knows about adaptive exercise? Do you have to use special equipment?
Mm-hmm. And the answer is no, you don't. You know, it might be a good idea to maybe get someone who can guide you a little bit in the beginning, but you don't need special equipment. I mean, the more movement you can do, the better, but keep in mind, for example, walking. Everyone can walk. Everyone knows how to walk. And you don't need much equipment. You need a decent pair of shoes. So as long as you have that, you can get out and start moving. You know, sure, some weight training would be great, but you can do some stuff at home as well. There's lots of, you know, TV stuff you can rent on the DVD or what have you to do some basic exercises just to start to strengthen your body a little bit. You know, of course, in addition to that, walking and so on.
We've been talking about aging and how it affects you. If you were in school and you and the gym teacher didn't quite get along and you couldn't climb the ropes and you couldn't do some of the apparatus and you figured, well, I'm just, that's just the way I am.
Mm-hmm.
Exercise, movement is not for me. I can't do it. Can you overcome that when you get older and it might benefit you? Or is that seared into your mind? Have you had many people who said, hey, wait a minute, I was always the clumsiest kid. Nobody wanted to play baseball with me. I'm 70. You're now expecting me to exercise. Don't bother me. Have you encountered that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So it's finding what will work well and what will work with somebody. So, for example, I'm not going to tell someone to swim if they don't know how to swim, even though it's a great exercise. So really finding what you like. Maybe it's walking. One thing that really, really helps with accountability is finding a friend to do it, a friend, a spouse, a coworker, what have you, so you can enjoy it and you don't even think you're exercising. You know, go out for a walk. I've worked with a lot of people who have done that, and actually just the other day, you know, now that it's getting colder, may not be as either safe or comfortable to walk outside. A lot of the malls open up early and then allow walkers inside. And I was at the mall really early the other day, and I happened to see a ton of people inside, and actually a lot of them did look a little bit older, and there were groups of them. So that could be another way. You meet at the mall, you go for a little walk inside, so it's warmer, it's more comfortable, but you're still getting that same benefit. I think that's really important as well.
Now, in closing, what advice would you have for people, and where can people get in contact with you if they think some of your knowledge could help them?
Well, you know, our website is more, M-O-H-R, results, R-E-S-U-L-T-S, .com.
And people can contact you through that? Or
yeah, absolutely.
Get contact information us through that? Through that?
Yeah. Absolutely. There's a blog on there with lots of this information and you know, much more. We talk exercise, nutrition, and diet and everything just to help people make those positive changes, some of which we talked about.
There are so many people in the diet and exercise business these days
that
it's hard to know. I won't say who to believe.
Right.
I'll be polite and say who would be a match for you. Where can you get decent referrals? Do you have that on your website? Could you give people decent referrals?
Yeah,
what's the best way to do that?
Well, we don't have that specifically, but on referrals. But you know, one website that does have that is it's called Eat EatRight.org EatRight.org, and you can actually type in your zip code, and you can find a dietitian in your area. So that, that's one way to do that.
I understand. Chris, thank you very much for being a guest on our show, and you have certainly taught me something.
Good, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
And have a good new year.
You too. Bye-bye.
Mary Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Harriet.
Aging at home is being called a trend. It's treated as if it's something new. But during earlier times, wasn't it simply the norm for people to age at home, being cared for by their family? Why are people talking about this trend as if it's something new?
Well, you're exactly right, Harriet. It's not new. In earlier times, yes, families lived closer together. We didn't have such a transient, mobile society, so families lived close and they took care of their elders. But now that's no longer the case, and so the term aging in place has kind of become the term for all the services that are needed to allow somebody to age in place that doesn't already have that built-in family living close by immediately in the home or even in their community. So, go ahead.
Or even if they do have a family living very nearby, they may not be able to handle all their needs. More women are working, so they couldn't be caretaking or caregiving during the day. And I suspect I'm right, some of the people who are now aging at home have more extensive medical needs than might have been the case in previous generations, that family members are just not equipped to handle.
That can be the case, or at least that's the perception often, because there is a lack of knowledge about all of the services that are available in the aging in place community. And so that's what, you know, what I think is necessary is for us to educate both the baby boomers who will be experiencing that themselves, or they may be caring for their parents. They need to know what resources are available to them to allow somebody to age in place. Because actually with the silver tsunami and so many baby boomers aging at the same time, there will be there's not enough beds in long-term care facilities or institutions to handle that sheer volume. So we will have to have home and community-based services to meet that need.
Tell us about some of the services that are offered. Now, everybody knows there's home health care aides, there's people who drive, things of that nature. What are some services? In other words, what is there available that might help somebody age at home who previously would have needed nursing home care? What technology or what services are available people should know about?
Absolutely. Well, a lot of states are developing home and community-based services even through Medicaid, because they've even seen that the cost is less to keep somebody at home. So in addition to the home care services, meal delivery is one that can be helpful. Companionship care, engagement. I mean, really, a lot of the studies show that seniors that stay engaged, that still feel a sense of purpose and dignity in their life, tend to have a better quality of life and a longer life, and are able to age at home easier. So they need to be looking at the community around them. Even some issues such as accessibility, you know, are there sidewalks? Can somebody walk around? Is there public transportation available or other transportation resources? And, of course, finances is always an issue where services might be needed. Connecting somebody up with a financial planner or an elder care attorney or even a reverse mortgage specialist to investigate that option.
Now, you're talking about services to help somebody age at home. Why is this arrangement something people might desire? What are some advantages of it? Why is it something people should even consider?
Well, actually, the AARP does a study every 10 years asking people that question, where do they want to be when they age? And the number is usually always around 80% of people want to remain in their homes in the community where they raise their families and where they have friends and connections. It's not really the norm for somebody to go to Florida or Arizona to retire to a retirement community. The majority of people want to remain in their homes. And the advantages of this, I mean, we have an attachment to our home and to that environment, and that familiarity, that sense of routine can be very helpful in keeping somebody independent and keeping maintaining their quality of life. And honestly, all the studies show that the cost is actually significantly less to remain in your home than to go into institutionalized care.
Okay, you talk about cost. You hinted at something before that I'd like to discuss. If I understand it correctly, and I believe I do, if you are in a nursing home, your expenses could potentially be handled by Medicaid. If you are aging at home, there may be some government services available, but truly they're not 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're not as intensive. So isn't financing one major obstacle to people staying at home when you can be in a nursing home and costs are covered by Medicaid? Isn't that a major problem?
Well, I think for some folks that may be a problem, but the reality is that there's only a percentage, probably less than 40% of people who would ever qualify for Medicaid nursing home payment anyway. So a lot of the states are adopting some of the what's called a waiver, Medicaid waiver program, that allows somebody to waive their right to long-term care benefits and use those funds for home and community-based services. And what they have found is that those are more effective. If we can keep somebody healthy and at home, the longer we can do that, then the less the cost is to the Medicaid programs. And so a lot of states are quickly growing their home and community-based services and spending the dollars there to expand those programs.
Okay, but mightn't you get caught in a squeeze? If I waive my right to get Medicare and I spend that money on home services and it gets to the point home services are just not realistic for me anymore, I need more than could be offered in a home, mightn't I be in a really rough situation?
Well, you're actually not waiving your right, and it is Medicaid, not Medicare, because Medicare does not cover long-term care, except for short-term stays. But Medicaid, mm-hmm. You waive, when I say you waive the right, basically people in the Medicaid waiver, home and community-based services programs, are waiving the right to go into a long-term facility at that point, meaning that they've reached the level of care where they may have to go into one of those facilities, but they feel like they want to use those funds to remain in their home. If the situation changes and they no longer can maintain in the home environment using, you know, home care and adult day health services, then they can still use their Medicaid to enter long-term care. So it's not waiving it completely. It's just the term, you know, basically it means they're using the funds in a different way.
Mm-hmm. But then you could later use those funds for long-term care.
They could, yes.
Now,
and hopefully they wouldn't need it, but yes, they're not waiving them for forever. So,
mm-hmm. Now, it would appear that aging at home has many great advantages. It allows somebody more privacy. The care can be shifted around them. In other words, it's not, okay, now you need to be in assisted living. Now you need to be in a nursing home. No, you don't. You don't have to go through that. It's now you're living at home. The
Correct.
Situation can be molded around you instead of you're having to mold into a situation.
Exactly.
That's wonderful. But when you hear these things and you understand the benefits of aging at home, it's easy to maybe be a bit misled as to how easy it is to carry out such an arrangement. What are some things people should look at before they say, yes, we can keep the grandma or grandpa or aunt or mother or whatever at home? What are some things they really need to be as sure of as you ever can?
Okay. Well, in something you said, Harriet, I wanted to address as we go into this topic, there used to be a way of looking at services for people aging as being a continuum. Like you said, that you would go from home to assisted living to long-term care, that there was like these step-downs to more intensive care,
mm-hmm.
or step-ups, if you would. But nowadays, there's a much more of a person-centered approach. It's not as cookie-cutter. There
mm-hmm.
is a realization that not everybody's the same, and there's not going to be one right answer for everybody. So, yes, it's true that not everybody might be able to age in place, but there are so many services and technologies out there now making that more of a viable option than it ever has been before. But that takes a little bit of a paradigm shift for us to be able to let go of some of the preconceived notions we had of somebody needing more intense care when, as we were talking about, the advantage of being in a familiar environment, that can't be overstated. I mean, people do have a higher quality of life. Lots of studies have shown that, and they have better health outcomes when they remain in their home. So, you know, looking at all of that is really important when a family is considering, you know, where to go with a loved one and where they should be cared for. And I think the key here is that you need to think about it and plan for it. Most of the time, people make these decisions in a crisis. And unfortunately, that's never the best time to make decisions, because then there's a lot of emotion and pressure going on there because you're in a crisis. So I think planning ahead is key.
How would you plan ahead? What are some ways you can do that?
Well, depending upon where you're starting from, you want to consider your physical environment. So the house where you are, you may want to stay in your community, but the house may not be, a three-story house that you raised your kids in may not be the appropriate environment for your 70s and 80s when you're going to be less mobile. So choosing the appropriate physical environment or making accommodations and changes to your existing environment to avoid such things as a fall, for example. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, you want to look at the surrounding environment and the community, and does it have the infrastructure to support aging in place? Health is another, biggie. I think somebody going into a situation where they want to age at home is going to do much better if they already have good health and not significant health issues, because obviously the more health issues or concerns you have, then the need for more intensive care is required. So, and then, of course, you have to look at your finances and plan. If you're looking at it early enough and you want to plan for long-term care insurance, now, if you choose the right plan, does cover home services. And so that is certainly something that needs to be considered. And then just staying engaged. I think seniors, as I said before, all the studies show those folks who stay engaged in a community in some way. And at some point, that may even become over social networking and over a computer. It's still being engaged, even if they aren't able to leave the house as often as they used to. Mm-hmm. So those are all the factors they need to plan ahead for.
Now, you touched on something I want to discuss a bit. Personalized care. It is very easy. For example, if somebody has a degree of dementia, to notice that blaring right out at you, oh my goodness, this person asked the same thing 5 times in 2 minutes. How could you not notice that it's blaring out at you? That it is sometimes easy to overlook the fact that there are also other moments when they remember things or understand things better than you ever figure they would. And I think if somebody is living at home, it is easier to really promote the good minutes than it would be in an institution. An institution has many people, many, many things to consider, many people with serious medical problems, and it might not be able to really give the type of energy to somebody's good moments that living at home can.
Absolutely. I completely agree that there are always moments of clarity, even as dementia progresses. And keeping somebody in an environment that they're already familiar with and in their normal routine, and, of course, medication management of the disease, all of those things would impact being able to keep somebody at home. There's technology now that can monitor somebody who, may not quite need 24-hour care yet, but is unsafe to leave alone for long periods of time. So there's video technology, there's monitoring technology that can be used. I think studies show as well, I'm not just saying that, but as a social worker, I can say that change to a facility when somebody is already experiencing the symptoms of dementia is traumatic and can often lead to further decline.
Okay, you talked about something, you brought it up, so I didn't have to, thank you. What happens, or how can you know when aging at home is no longer appropriate for somebody? What might be some signs? How do you handle that? That is kind of the very ugly, I won't say ugly, that's that's the wrong word. That's the very, very difficult aspect to what we're discussing, when you have to say, look, this is no longer working. How do you handle that? How do you know that?
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go back to, I wish there was a, you know, one answer. I think it's going to be very individualized to that person. But I do think, as a social worker, I would say the one key thing would be when somebody would become a danger to themselves or to others. But again, oftentimes if there are behaviors like that, sometimes it just needs an evaluation of medication changes or medication interactions. So again, each case is individualized, but, other situations that I've seen, being a social worker in this field, is when it's the caregiver is done, is burnout, that's an old term now, but if the caregiver hasn't used a lot of services and has put all the work on them, then at some point their health can be impacted, and then, oftentimes the family decides, well, now is the time, because, the caregiver can no longer handle the situation. So those would be the two most common things that I see for somebody not being able to stay at home and continue in that situation. But like I said, I think it's very, very specific to each individual, and so I wouldn't want to generalize, because sometimes situations can be improved upon when you, have a support team of people trying to make it work.
Can you think of an example where the family was feeling a crisis and having a rough time because they thought, look, we can no longer keep this person at home? You came in, or another social worker came in and said, yeah, you can. You just have to be aware of this, this, and this services, and you were able to help them?
I specifically can't think of one personally that I was involved with recently, but I know within our Aging in Place chapter, we have geriatric care managers who assist families all the time with this type of situation, even doing some mediation. A lot of times within a family, there is one particular person who is just, really bent on putting somebody into a facility for whatever reason. There might be fears of somebody getting hurt or falling or... But a lot of times it becomes a battle within a family because not everybody's on the same page about that. But I know, and having seen people utilizing some of these services, that as long as you can support a caregiver and that they'll use the services available, a lot of times people have a hard time letting go and delegating. They want to be there all the time, and that just can't work. Eventually that's going to take its toll on the caregiver. So I think it works best when the family and the caregiver are open to having others in the home, open to other people taking on some of the burdens of the care and the daily routines.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about your group. How did it get formed? What type of support does it offer?
Okay. Well, the National Aging in Place Council is a national group that's an association of service providers that support aging in place. And there are several chapters, or many chapters, around the country for people to access services in their local environment of all these different types of providers that I mentioned to you that can assist with successful aging in place The chapter that I'm involved with, we do a lot of education and advocacy. So several times in a month, we're offering educational programs to consumers about just what we're talking about, planning ahead, what do you need to think about, how can you put these things in place now before a crisis. And we do those presentations around the community, and as well we do advocacy work locally to support legislative items that would impact seniors wanting to age in their homes. And those chapters are around the country, and we're growing quickly because, as you said early on, this is kind of the buzzword right now, and aging in place is what everybody is talking about and wanting to know more about.
How did you happen to get involved in your group? How did that happen for you?
Well, I am actually a licensed clinical social worker, and I've been a medical social worker and worked in home health environments, hospice environment, long-term care, adult day health environments. And about 4 years ago, I was working for a home accessibility company that actually had a social worker on board. So if somebody wanted to have their home evaluated for how to make it more accessible and make modifications to it, we would go out and do an assessment of the home. And what I realized was, you know, we could fix the physical environment, make it safe, make it much less likely for them to fall, but if they weren't connected to all the other services that were necessary to them, then they still wouldn't have as good of a chance of making it, staying at home. So that's where the social worker role came in, and just trying to bring together those other pieces of the puzzle. So I started educating out in the community about it, and with doing my research, I found the National Aging in Place Council. It was fairly new at the time, and just found out how to get a local chapter started, and really, it was pretty amazing. We put an ad in the paper for a presentation at a library on aging in place, and we had 41 people show up, and out of that, about 10 to 12 said they wanted to go ahead and get a chapter started, and off we went. And now we're 60-plus members strong. And like I said, holding monthly educational events. And we do twice a year educational events for social workers as well, so that we can, and discharge planners, hospital discharge planners and nurses, so that they can be familiar with the resources out there. Because like I said, oftentimes people don't start thinking about these things until they've gone through a crisis. So they're in the hospital because they had a fall or they had a health issue, and now they're being discharged. So we want the discharge planners to know about all the services that are available, so that it's not an immediate decision to say, well, they need to go into institutionalized care. So we're really just working on educating our community from the consumer perspective as well as the service providers.
How has working with this council and working with elders changed the way you view aging? Many people really fear aging. It's something they don't want to see, hear about, or anything else. How has your work changed the way you view aging?
Well, it's funny that you would say that. I've always had just a love of seniors and wisdom of people who've been around longer than I have and have amazing stories to tell. But in working with this organization, it's become more and more clear, and what you're saying is true. In our society, everybody avoids aging, and it's kind of a nasty term, and we don't ever think about ourselves getting older. We all think of ourselves as 10 or 20 years younger than we really are, which is great, but not when you're being avoidant of what is coming. So for me, I have tried to become a champion of, you know, how amazing aging can be and what a positive experience it can be, and that we need to, you know, change our, we need to have a paradigm shift in the United States about how we think about aging and our elders. So, and there's so many ways that we can do that. So we, in our organization, are always trying to come up with new intergenerational activities, ways to connect seniors with high school students, or bringing young people together with the seniors, again, hoping that that will change their perception so that as they get older and become the caregivers for the baby boomers, that they will have just a different respect, a different view of aging.
In closing, what hints would you have, final hints for people who are considering keeping an elder at home, and how can people get in contact with your organization?
Well, I think my my tip would be to have the conversation. You know, find out if you're, what your mother or father wants. So many times we avoid the discussion about death, dying, aging, all of those things. So have the conversations, find out what their wishes are, and be thinking about how you can put those plans in place. And if you already, if your parents are already gone, then think about that for yourself. Where do you want to be, and what do you want your life to look like after retirement? And to access, you know, all the services that we offer in Aging in Place Council, you can go to ageinplace.org. And you can search your city where you live and find services of all these different types that we've discussed today available to you in your local community.
Mary Lee, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you, Harriet. I enjoyed it.
And here is the additional information about continuing care retirement communities. I promised many of them are now partnering with colleges and universities across the country as they locate in college towns such as Oberlin, Ohio, or Ithaca, New York. This arrangement can be a win-win situation for all involved. It allows seniors to enjoy all the amenities a college town might have to offer, and it can also provide the town with a welcome source of volunteers, taxpayers, and customers for local stores. For more information about these communities and other matters related to aging, check out my website at www.htramer.com, www.htramer.com. And be sure to show us that you like us. Thank you.